Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be talking to the great Nikki Haslam, singer, writer, interior designer, most importantly, distinguished Oldie contributor, and writer of the famous Common List. The most recent one is Common Things About Art, which include Downlit Art, Christie's, and the Sistine Chapel. And some of them are there as jokes, is that right?
Well, sort of, but I think the Sistine Chapel is extraordinarily ugly. Its walls are hideous.
Yeah.
And the only good paintings are the stupid on the ceiling.
Have to lie on your back.
Yeah.
But with your list, which I love, it strikes me they're very funny, but quite often there's a bit of seriousness in your list of art things that are common. You brilliantly point out the word interpreted, which I hate.
Yeah.
So they're often nailing idiocy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And also just nailing things that actually annoy one about art, but sort of I can't name specific artists, but there's a one having a show in Paris at the moment who people go bonkers about. These are boring, ugly pictures, and it just annoys me that he...
Well, I think your line is this specific artist can't paint, but he draws like an angel.
Can't paint for toffee, I said.
Yes.
But he can't, but he does draw exquisitely, as good as Andy.
Yeah.
As good as Sheena.
Andy Warhol, I must say, I'm interviewing Nikki Haslam in his wonderful flat on the Cromwell Road, being stared down by three Nikki Haslams, one naked, and two by Andy Warhol.
Well, they're not, actually, but I'm going to sign them, Andy Warhol, and have done with it.
And you made him, didn't you? You created
three,
Andy
four.
No, four. You created Andy
No,
Warhol.
I didn't create him at all, but I met him when he was very, very, very early starting. He wasn't known at all in any circles except his own small, brilliant circle of the people who were in the studio, in the factory. But he used to bring, when I was working on Vogue, he used to bring his drawings into Vogue, because he did sort of illustrated, you know, bags and headscarves and all that. Beautiful, like just as good as Sheena, really as good as Sheena.
And but you didn't know, obviously, what he was going to break into, but could you...
Well, I did, sort of, because he started painting the first pop pictures. And among the first were the Brillo boxes.
Yeah.
And my sister was married to the Brillo heir, my American sister. So I used to take them up to her, and she said, I ought to buy some of these, they're going to be valuable one day. She liked sort of frightfully grand modern art. And I said, I'm going to buy some. And I said, good God, I've got the real stuff, I don't want these.
And so she didn't.
No, she didn't.
No, sadly. Again, in your other brilliant common lists, you've got some brilliant targets. The Welsh Guards.
I don't know why that's on. There's a reason it's put on. I know the reason, but I don't know why the reason. Somebody called Richard Bendian.
Yes.
Who I love.
Yes, former.
Just said to me, yeah, you must put the Welsh Guards on. And so I did, but not knowing the reason. And then I saw him a bit later, and he said, thanks a bunch for putting the Welsh Guards on. I said, well, you told me to. He said, it didn't make it very easy for my meeting the other day with the Colonel in Chief. Of course, it's the King.
And that was in comparison to the other Guards regiments.
I don't know. I know nothing about Guards regiments at all. They're not in my world.
But other things include the Telegraph crossword, because it's gone downhill. Was it the Telegraph?
No, it's just easier.
Yeah. But then in among them all, there are some very true ones. Podcasts. I'm sorry, we're now doing a podcast. Is this very common?
Well, no, but they have become common. The common is also a sense of what's become ordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, accepted. You know, they were. I mean, I did the first one ever with Chris Sweeney, years and years ago. But now everybody has a podcast except me.
Yes. Well, thank God you're doing one. And then one of your greatest is loving your parents. Now, did you love your parents, Nikki?
Not much. I mean, I didn't love them, but I didn't love them as a distraction like people have to these days. Loving your parents, that came from Cecil, a book called Juliet Duff.
I can't do her. No,
Juliet Duff was wonderful Otis Edwardian, the mother of Michael Duff, the and she and her son never got on. And she was, I was staying with them at the week with Juliet one weekend, and she got off the train to Cecil, and she said, she put the version, you could tell Cecil's common loves his mother.
And your father, William, was a diplomat. Your mother had the brilliant name of Diamond, is that right?
Yeah, because she was born on the day of the Diamond Jubilee.
Wonderful.
And her mother, her godmother was Queen Victoria.
Because her family, the Besperers, were very close.
Yeah.
To the,
yeah. Well, they were, her cousin ran the court, but Fritz Ponsonby ran the court. And I discovered the other, her mother, who I knew... I mean, I've met older people. I knew, I could have met her. I actually knew this one. My grandmother was born in 1847. My grandmother.
My God. So she was quite an old mother.
Just have two people who lived to 90.
Yeah. Yeah. She was quite an old mother then when she...
Yes, she was. She'd had one marriage in America, and then I had three brothers, one of whom died. Before me, so she was, yes, she wasn't young or spring chicken at all.
But made her, was she a remote mother or what?
She... No, she was rather hands on. She was not fun. I didn't love them. It's a strange thing. I liked being with them. I didn't love them. Like every English boy loved his nanny.
Yeah.
Adored my nanny, and that was my, well, Teresa was the love of my life.
Ah.
Long, long time. I've just written about her.
When did she die?
She disappeared, actually. Well, she left me when I was rude to her.
Oh.
My first half had eaten. I came back sort of cocky and I said something rude to her. And she left almost the next day.
Oh.
Broke her heart.
Never saw her again.
Well, I did see her. That's a long, yes. Very strange story. I then found her roots in Austria. And found all the one is peasant woman gave me an envelope. Dirty envelope. She threw it on the table and up flew photographs of me with my darling Nicky written on it. It was so tough. Oh, I'm going to cry. Sorry.
And your father was a diplomat. Where did he serve?
In Rome, the embassy, the Rennell Rod, the dullest embassy in the world.
But
and
he...
Francis Rennell was my godfather.
Oh, yes. So you knew Peter Rod, who then married Nancy Smith.
Yeah. It was Peter Rod I knew quite well.
And he was much mocked with the...
I rather liked Peter. He was wonderful looking, must be said. And he was a bit sort of... Not pompous, as the wrong word, a bit talkative in a way about himself quite a lot. I think he had an affair with my mother. I'm not sure.
Really?
I think so.
And poor him, mocked by Nancy Mitford as Prod.
Yeah. No, well, everybody called him Prod.
Oh. No.
They were all called Frod, Grod. Golly was called Grod, Prod, Frod, Trod for Taffy. They were all called that.
And were you all very funny, Nicky? Were your parents funny?
Well, I don't remember them being funny, but I'm sure they were to their generation. She was quite... Yes, she had a sense of humour, my mother. My father did too, a bit too, but they were so old, I was so much older than me that I... And I always think it's so sad that I never asked them about anything in their life, like the Russian Revolution or the abdication or whatever. Didn't want to hear them talking, really.
Yes, because how old were you when they died?
My father died at 99, and I suppose in about 79 or 80 or something. My mother died at 86.
You had polio, as did my... cousin Thomas Pakenham, and his sister Antonia Fraser the other day said she thought the polio he had when he was young was vital in making him very tough and energetic later on. Do you think it has?
I think it certainly gives you, because of all the, I don't know if he had it, but I had so much penicillin injection, it certainly inured me against the other diseases. My leg is not slightly very bad from it. But I think it does give one a kind of being in bed for three. Well, that was the thing. I was in my bed for quite a long time, and I only knew grown-ups. I never knew children. There weren't any children around, so I only ever was always brought up with grown-ups.
So it became very competent.
I've always liked grown-ups more than children, you know. Yes.
But
but a lot of people had... I mean, Tony Stone had at the same time as me, and Chrissy had a group, Gibbs had a bit later, but there was a... It was a 1947 pre-Salk.
Right, yes, that'd be exactly... with Thomas Antoni said it made him realise life was for living.
Yeah.
Spent. How old were you when you had it?
Seven, I suppose.
Yeah, same sort of age. And my dad, the writer Ferdy Mount, knew you at Eton and said you're completely unchanged from it, and said you're this extremely talented original designer of the Chronicle, the school magazine. So from that young age, you were immediately interested in aesthetics.
Yeah, and, yeah. I mean, the wonderful thing was that Wilfred Blunt, the art teacher, really... I mean, he gave me any good report I had at Eton. The genius of his generation, he said. But so I spent my life in the art schools and doing that kind of stuff, getting out of games and, you know...
But you're extremely clever. Why were you not interested in the other subjects?
Well, I'm not very clever at math. I was bottom of Eton math for three halves, I think.
But English, you're a terrific writer.
English I was quite good at, and languages. Not that we didn't do much more than Latin. I wasn't clever enough to start doing Greek, French, yes.
And you wrote a very good article for The Oldie a few years ago about the advantages of not going to university. Do you think that it keeps your mind more original, do you think?
Well, I think it makes you do things sooner that are more advantageous in later life, is all I can say. I say that for somebody who couldn't possibly have gone to university. I'd be so far too dim.
Well, no, but you're much cleverer than a lot of people who do go, but... you wouldn't have wanted to.
No, not... Well, I don't think it was even offered to me, frankly. I thought they said no. Anyway, I left Eton so quickly, as soon as I could, because I met all these lovely grown-ups in London. I'm seeing Simon Fleet and Buddy Roger and Hardy Amis and Oliver Messman, Beaton and all that world. It was so... That was what I wanted to be there. I didn't want to go shut off in Oxford or Cambridge or Hull or somewhere.
And because, as you said, you dealt with grown-ups from a young age, you felt very confident with those distinguished grown-ups.
Yes, I did. I sort of felt, because I'd always seen adults, I sort of felt myself as adult in a kind of way, on their level rather than on children's levels.
Yes.
Or not children, youth.
And
though I loved youth as well, like David Bailey and all that, that side as well.
And quite soon, you went to America, is that right?
I went to America in 61.
Yeah.
With David Bailey and Jean. And I went for what I thought was 3 weeks to... I had an idea of opening up a nightclub here in London. Thought we'd go and suss out the nightclubs in New York. And when I was there, I was off this job on Vogue, and I stayed 11 years.
And you wrote extremely moving piece in The Oldie about... meeting Marilyn Monroe. Can you tell us?
That was an extraordinary... Well, I'd seen her. Of course, I used to run away from Eton to see her films. I remember rushing along Agar's Plough, whatever, into the bushes at Slough and getting into a soldo or something to see No Business Like Show Business. We were mad about Marilyn. And I'd seen her once in Hollywood, looking very glamorous. But then when it was on Vogue and... she'd been photographed for the first time naked by Bert Stern. And it was a secret. I found out because I was very close to the art director. And as I was the only person who knew about it, they suddenly found she had permission. She had, what's it called? Proper out of the pictures.
Yeah.
So Priscilla Peck said to me, take these pictures up to Miss Monroe and get her to look at them. So I went up sort of 6:30 one evening and rang the doorbell at 57th Street, wherever I come up. And she came to the door and she was... The dog barked for ages, a dog barking. Then she came and she opened the door and she was absolute wreck. Sweaty face, dirty hair, very dirty clothes. She'd obviously been through a nightmare of the last few days or hours. And she looked at her, she put her finger through the ones she didn't like, and And then the telephone rang again, and she said, "I've got to go now." She just ran down, leaving the door open, with the dog following her. It was extraordinarily tragic. She died 3 weeks later.
But looked wonderful in the photos, so she could...
She still
brushed up well.
Yes, she could have, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Friendly, though, was she to you?
Sweet, yeah. Touching. Oh, honey, you know, I don't feel great. I'm not in a good state. It was like all that, you know. She said, I haven't got time. And I said, "Please, Miss Lynn." Oh, she said, "Oh, OK, I'll look at them." And she was so touching. Oh. It was extraordinary.
And it was about the same time you met Cole Porter, wasn't it?
About the same time. Yeah. Met Cole, I suppose about before a year, exactly. Yeah.
And he became quite a friend, didn't he?
Well, yes, he did. I mean, I thought he was a friend because I was just so in awe of him, but he was so nice to me. And he did ask me, I used to go to dinner with him alone, or he'd ask me for the weekend in the country, the weekend before he actually fell and had to go to hospital, and then I didn't see him again. But I was just astonished it was Cole Porter. I remember, because when I was ill and with polio, my mother had a gramophone. She'd bring all the LPs of shows back from America, and she'd roll out the carpet and dance with our friends in my bedroom. So I knew word perfect. I thought I was Ethel Merman for a long time in my life. he was my idol.
And you think he's the best? I mean, they're incredible, those American songbook writers. He's the best of Irving Berlin, Gershwin.
Well, they're all pretty wonderful. Yeah. I think Cole always had a sort of insouciance to all his lyrics. Berlin is more of a... He had a bit of enthusiasm, but he's tougher in a way. Cole had that light-hearted quality. I'm not so mad about the Gershwins. One or two songs are great, of course, but they're all wonderful. As you say, we ought to do a book something on the lyrics.
Yes, well, we were discussing it because you also performed beautifully the songs of Cole Porter and Cabaret, which I saw you in the Pizza Express.
I've just done a CD.
Oh, fantastic!
They found all the recordings of my Cabaret.
When's that coming out?
Guy Chambers. He's Robbie Williams.
Oh, yes.
He's a great man.
Very grand, yeah.
And his technician has just put the songs together, taking out all the bumps and the bips.
Oh, when's
we're
going
to put that on a CD.
When's that out?
Well, he's just doing this very as we speak. He's doing it. So it's about a month's time.
You said to me the other day, you didn't like the lyric, which I think is terrific. Of he could take you any place you want to fancy clubs and restaurants. I like those little twists.
Well, it's a very bad lyric, but it's funny.
Yes. Yeah. Do you have a favourite Cole Porter song or lyric?
Not really, because they're all so wonderful. They're in different moods. I mean, I think in the end, what's it called? My mind's going. In the Still of the Night is one of the greatest songs, which is a sort of frustrated love song.
It's very sad, isn't it? Yeah. They're often very sad. Actually, when you sing them, they're often very moving and melancholy, aren't they?
Yeah.
You're like a sort of Zelig of the 20th and 21st century. You've met everyone, and you're friends with lots of them.
Did I tell you I'd met Kerensky?
No.
That's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. Where was that?
In New York. He lived there after that. Because when he was head of the president of the Duma, he was only like 40. And of course, he came to New York. He must have been 60 or something in New York 20 years later, 30 years later.
Yes.
And a lot of those Russians lived in New York. But it's quite grand. I hated Studio 54.
Oh, really? Because?
Tacky.
Oh, really?
I liked El Barocco. I like girls in backless dresses saying bitchy things to each other.
And you must have come across Truman Capote.
Oh, very well, yes.
Got on well with him?
He used to come and stay at the ranch a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I loved Truman. He was dangerous. Well, it depended on what mood he could be very touchy in a way, Truman.
very witty.
Yeah, yeah. I remember coming to the ranch and I said, what are you writing now? And he said, oh, he said, I'm writing a little book about my friends. It's going to be called Ants and Prayers. Oh, look out.
And it did a wonderful, short book, and destroyed him.
Yeah.
It did.
But actually, drugs and drink and madness destroyed him as writing.
But he got those grand ladies, the swans, right, did he?
Some of them, yes. Yeah. Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I knew Babe a bit, and I knew Pamela Harriman very well. I knew some of the swans quite well. But they were really after my time in New York. It was when I went to Arizona, the ranch. They were the sort of great 60s characters, no, 70s characters.
Yeah.
But I was back here by then.
Because you had your own ranch and you bred Arab horses, is that right?
Yeah, a friend of mine and I bought a ranch outside of Phoenix. In the so-called desert, but it luckily had a river, which had been rather rare.
And had you been brought up with horses, did you?
But as a child, I loathed them. I fell off, was dragged across a railway line. I was terrified of horses. But that English saddle I find very difficult, a Western saddle. And I got quite good at it. I could ride bareback and I could throw a rope. Not necessarily getting the steer when I was capable, but I could make it work. And I could ride without bridle and everything.
And it was quite a big operation, was it?
No, it was quite a big ride. Well, it wasn't very big. But it had quite a lot of land. We used to lease the land to a big ranch owner near there, who's called Udall. I think he can pay him a senator, I think. And Udall's a very old English name. Udall's in Elizabethan court.
Oh, yes, there was, I think, who taught Elizabeth I,
yeah.
Taught her Latin, I think, yeah. Well, you described once in one of your lovely articles of the Oldie an extraordinary evening in New York in 1963 where you met Lena Horne, Duke Ellington, Frank Sinatra, Louis Armstrong, and Martin Luther King.
Yeah, and Coretta.
And Coretta.
Yeah.
Pretty good haul.
Well, I went with Lena and...
Was it Frank's son you went with, or...?
No, Frank was giving the party for his son.
Right, yeah.
After one of Frank's son's concerts. And I went with Duke Ellington and Billy Strayhorn and Lena to the party. Because Lena was a great friend. I met her here then. I had a sort of romance with her daughter, Gail. I adored Gail. She was wonderful.
But the nature of parties then... Well, actually, as now, we're both off the Spectator party in a moment. That'll be... crammed with quite a few people, though not many quite as glamorous as Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. But
there are too many people in the world these days. There were a much smaller circle those days.
And you, particularly in New York, I always think I used to live in New York, Manhattan's incredibly small, isn't it? So you'd bump into the great and the good.
Yeah.
And very little security.
Well, not much of the good, I'm glad to say.
And
I didn't see much of Mayor Moses or anybody.
Yeah. And very little security.
None at all.
Everyone very approachable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was a goal. To be in New York in the 60s, early 60s, was paradise. And there was the theatre, there were the arts, all that was starting. It was an extraordinary time to be there. It was the end of a century rather than an era of New York then.
You think you were catching the sort of New York that might have been around in the 20s and 30s.
A lot of it was like the 1880s. I mean, there was real proper Edwardian dowagers still, all of whom had palazzos in Rome or, you know, they were American, and Hotel Particulier in Paris, and travelled across in boats with tons of luggage and cars and things. Still went on.
And
there were still private trains.
There you go.
And I was there.
And beautifully dressed, you wrote another article for the Oldie, great one about Dior and how clothes of everyone, but of the rich, have gone downhill. That you said sexiness is now in your face when it was once hinted at.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, isn't it? Fetishism's become normal.
Yeah.
The only point of a fetish, it was sort of secret.
Yes. And it's not shocking when you see someone dressed in a leather gimp
or rubber dress or something. It's just not shocking anymore.
Yeah. And you describe kind of rich people now dressing in fairy princess hodgepodge.
Did I?
Yeah.
It's rather good.
Very good. But people, who do you think still is very well dressed? King's well dressed, don't you think?
I'd rather not answer.
Yeah.
I think he's very interestingly dressed.
Yeah.
And I think. I think Prince Philip was wonderfully dressed. Oh, yeah. God, he was well dressed.
Yes.
Duke of Kent's wonderfully dressed. Old Duke of Kent, wonderful clothes.
Yes.
Well, you've been a men over who well dressed. You mean? Brown Ferry's very well dressed.
He looks brilliant, yeah.
A cousin of mine called Rupert de Morley, Punsonby, Lord de Morley,
was
master of the horse.
Yes.
Unbelievable his clothes. Yes. I mean, you die the beauty of everything the way it's cut.
Yes, yes.
For women, it's harder because women. Women sort of don't have to change their look. At it. The whole point when I was young, women had the right outfit for the morning. They go home and change for lunch. Then they go home and change for the afternoon for tea with a friend. They go and change for cocktail, and then they go and change for dinner. So you never wear to dinner a long dress.
And Nicky, your style, you're wearing a very elegant Fred Perry, it's actually Fred Perry top, and beautiful tracksuit bottoms and Levi's trainers. Elegant. And you've got striking complete confidence in how you look, because you change a lot, don't you?
I just try and look up to date.
Yeah.
That's all really. I don't get stuck in a time warp. But there was a time I wanted to look at the Duke of Beaufort. I don't anymore. That they have to talk about well dressed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there was a time you what would you call it, kind of slight Oasis look you went for?
Well, people keep saying it was, but just that whole sort of Oasis look came in and I wore the clothes. I mean, I wasn't trying to be Oasis. It was. I did actually know what's he called.
The Gallaghers.
Yeah.
No,
Lord the other Liam. One. Yeah. Liam. And he sort of got to know that I was meant to be looking like. And I saw him in the Ritz in Paris one day, and he said, "God, you don't look a bit like me anymore. What's gone wrong?"
And, Nick, I think was it 1972 you began your interior design business?
Yeah, coming back from New York.
And what was the spark behind that?
Because I would have worked on magazines, and I didn't want to go on, but then for 5 years I was in Hollywood and I did a bit of work for Dominic Dunn in Hollywood. I did a bit of decoration for Natalie Wood. I did some, and I'd been on the ranch. I really hadn't done anything proper that earned a crust for 10 years. And Alexander Hesketh used to come to the ranch a lot.
Yeah.
And he'd bought a house in London. He loved the ranch. He loved the flat in New York. And he said, "Would I decorate for him?" Which that was my first. But of course, when I started, he sold the house. I didn't do any of it. But then I got people like Mark Shand and Nicholas Sims, all those young ones. And they were such lovely to work for.
And what sort of look did you give their
whatever places? The house tells you what to do. You can't give them a look. You give
the shape of the rooms or feeling
of the room. Rooms speak. Rooms tell you what to do.
And we're sitting, for the listener's point of view, in Nicky's lovely, huge, high-ceilinged flat with some semi-Andy Warhols, a wonderful Piranesi-style drawing. Is that over the fireplace?
Well, it's not. It's very nearly Piranesi. It's actually it's a Jean Cocteau face. You see.
Oh yes.
And a friend of mine, a wonderful art collector, has a tiny thing I covet most of it all, which is a gold Jean Cocteau face with a sort of Dali in it. So I just sort of did a version of it.
Portraits of your mother and Prue Penn, who was a cousin of the Queen, wasn't she? Prue Penn?
No, my best friend, but not a cousin.
And all wonderful things, but I've just been reading your very good book, Folie de Grandeur, about your lovely old house.
That was nice, wasn't it? It's a very nice book.
Really good, but it strikes me, who is no expert on these things, that the thing to avoid is anything too matchy-matchy.
Yes. and break the rules. People think you have to have small furniture in small rooms. Not at all, but big furniture. The room looks much bigger. I mean, you could... And also, you have to scale the furniture of the person. It's all about... Actually, if I'm being honest, I think decoration is all about making people look prettier, feel better, but relaxed. I hate the word relaxed, which is so common.
Yes, yes.
But feel at home.
As well as more literal things like the lighting and the effect of the lighting
on exactly.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Yes. Not feeling
and shadow, people like far too much light. Shadows are incredibly important in decor. The play of shadows.
To get contrast.
That's why this is painted by those things. It's to make it look as if there's panelling. And panelling was always meant to make light and shade.
Oh, yes. Thus, the hell of staying in a minimalist boutique hotel, which is all one plane of glass or
I hate light. I think we've got plenty of electric light these days. We don't need light.
And also surround yourself with objects you love as well.
What's it called? Not nostalgia. Souvenirs. I love souvenirs. I love things that remind. I love ashtrays that remind me of restaurants in Turkey or plates like that. Which under in a room, I'll give it. And I love things that remind me of friends.
And Nicky, the business became really quite huge.
Yeah, it got very big, especially when I got all those oligarchs.
Yeah.
Abramovich and what's he called? The one with the beginning with O.
Can't do him.
Yeah, I do.
And do you have free reign with them?
Yeah.
Would you change your look depending on whether they're a Russian oligarch or I don't know?
Well, you know what to do with. I mean, certain races you know what to do with. There are certain things that you don't do with. You don't put. What is it? Russians, they don't like any like statues because they remind them of museums because they're so. They like sort of new. There are certain sort of taboos that you know to avoid with various clients.
And I read Russians, perhaps even your clients, like huge lateral spaces. They don't like lots of staircases and old fiddly houses.
Yeah.
And Nikita, all the time you've written wonderfully, not just for the Oldie, but for other nameless publications and terrific memoirs. What a wonderful writing style. That must come from deep, deep reading.
Yeah, it does. I read quite well. I've not read enough lately, but I feel because I was meant to do this book and I've just cancelled it. I think it's. I'm very careful about my writing. I mean, I look almost every word I use up in the thesaurus to see if there's a more appropriate word for it.
Yes.
I don't. I can't bear using the same word twice in a paragraph or anything. You know.
Yes. Yeah.
I think I'm quite a good stylist in that way.
Yes, and very good. But syntax as well. You play
really
around.
That's been learning from writers I admire like Sybil Bedford and Janet Flanner. I think he's a wonderful writer. Funny, all the writers I like are women. Gertrude Stein, I think, is a wonderful writer. She really, when I was very young, when I was at school, I read the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, and it made such an impact on me, the way she wrote.
Evelyn Waugh, do you like your...
Yes, I do. Yeah. Funny enough, I'd never read Brideshead until the other day. Of course, I was in tears when I did.
Oh, yes, I think it's terrific. It's always wrong, yeah.
And even Nancy Mitford is a great stylist.
Oh, she's terrific.
Yeah.
Very, very funny.
Yeah.
And your love words, when I interviewed our mutual friend Graydon Carter a couple of weeks ago when he was over here, I said I thought the world's worst sentence was "Do you know who I am?" And he said that you said the world's worst sentence was "Tasting menu," not a sentence. But then you updated it when I talked to you. You said your latest least favourite phrase is Thames Basin.
Yes, it's very depressing about Thames Basin, isn't it?
Yes, but it's the sound, that's why you've got a very good ear, the sound, it sounds sort of sanitary.
Graydon got the book done, he got the whole, that off the ground.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, I was...
Nicky's pointing to his memoir, Redeeming Features.
I'd written a bit of it at Bazaar Point. The first issue of Vanity Fair, Graydon put it in saying I was writing the... And about 10 years later, he said, where's that book you were writing? I said, well, he said, come on, get on with it. I'll get you a publisher. And he got me a Knopf.
And made
me finish it. It was entirely due to Graydon.
Well, he's a, unlike a lot of journalists, he's a great encourager of other people.
Yeah.
Dick, we must go because we're off the Spectator party. You wrote a terrific piece for us about common pitfalls at Christmas parties. Are there any common pitfalls at summer parties?
Well,
not particularly the Spectator, but generally things to avoid.
I don't know. I mean, depends what the party is. You mean cocktail party or dinner party?
Yeah, a cocktail party, yeah.
Well, don't have food you can't eat one bite, which is rightful bowl.
Yeah.
Don't have those awful bowls and plates and spoons. Ugh, those awful spoons people have. Those sort of porcelain spoons. Ugh.
Yes.
Enough ice. I don't like cold drinks, but people do. And as Diana Cooper said, the perfect recipe for a good party is too much to drink and a chocolate pudding.
Well, that's very, very
true, isn't it?
It's perfect. Very, very good place to stop. Thank you so much to Nicky Hazem for appearing on Radio Oldie.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.